Osiris.
RJ, I'm doing great, I think. I just watered some flowers.
Wow.
Listening to some Dave Matthews.
Wow.
I've got a bagel coming to me at some point this morning. I don't know when it's going to get here.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be here. You know, it's July 6th. I'm doing good.
That's
awesome.
I've
got Wimbledon on in the background, watching Nadal. He's fighting. He's behind in the third set. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, we're going to find out, and I'm glad that you're able to... check that out. We are literally today, we're moving and shaking, and part of that involves me moving and shaking back to my home. And so for a couple of different reasons, we're gonna try something a little different today. We're gonna keep it a little shorter, and we're gonna look at some themes as opposed to walking through each of the songs in the show, which is Live Tracks 5 from 1995 in Rochester Hills, Michigan, the Meadowbrook Music Fest. So I guess the first thing I want to say is, I mentioned this yesterday, and I'll keep mentioning it. If you're going to be at the Philly Man shows, or if you live in Philly, or if you want to come hang out with us, we have a show that's happening on Monday, July 18th, less than 2 weeks away, with Tom Hamilton, Chris Forsythe, Dano Donato, and a bunch of awesome musicians. I'm going to be interviewing them. They're going to play music. It's going to be a fantastic evening. If you go to OsirisPod.com/OsirisLive. You can see the ticket information, and you can also get tickets to the show that we just announced in Denver on August 31st with Taper's Choice, which Brian will be leading that ship. Would you say you'll be steering that ship?
I hope I'm the one. Yeah, I think I'm steering that ship. If I'm not steering that ship, I don't know who's steering that ship. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm going to take the torch from Philadelphia. And I'm going to pass it off to Taper's Choice. They're going to take it. I don't know what they're going to do with it. It's kind of like the Stanley Cup. You know, they're going to hang out with it. They're going to take it to their families, show them the torch. And then at some point we'll pass it around again. Who knows? It's the summer of torches.
There's torching happen. So let's get into this, because we have a lot to talk about. First of all, we're going back to 1995. We're going outside of Detroit. We're going to Rochester Hills, Michigan. Rochester Hills, right? Yeah. Which is
Rochester
Hills. Outside of Detroit. Brian, what's the deal with this festival? I know that Phish played there in 93. What else do you have to tell the people about Live Tracks 5 before we actually get into it?
So it's interesting, because I think the name festival is actually the venue, which is a little misleading. I think that they just had concerts and they decided to call this venue the Meadowbrook Music Fest, which existed ongoing for the last 60 odd years now. This venue was built in the early 1960s, 1964. It's on the Oakland University campus. It looks like a barn. It's really, really beautiful, and then it spreads out into this lawn. It's one of those pictures that when you look at it, you remember. And I think about this every time I go back to Michigan. I grew up in Illinois, and every time I go to Michigan, I'm like, my God, this is just such a beautiful state that gets discussed for all the wrong reasons on a national level. But like, you get out in the country of Michigan, and it is just gorgeous, gorgeous place in America. And this looks like a part of it. The original goal of the venue was to provide a space for classical music. It was very, very popular out the gates. There was a steady drop off in interest in the late 1960s, but today it hosts a number of bands who weave through the Midwest and want an alternative to Pine Knob. As we're contractually obligated to say, Phish played there in 1992 and 1993, a really good show in 1993, but it looks like a smaller version of Alpine Valley is kind of the best way I can describe it. It's lush, it's Midwestern, it's like a farm. It's a beautiful little spot, and it's kind of the perfect venue for Dave Matthews at this point in time, coming 8 days past their Red Rock show in mid-August 1995.
So, okay, that's helpful. There's a lot going on in 95. It was a big year for me, because I started driving, saw my first Fish show. I think I got my first like serious girlfriend. I think it was a pretty good year, 95. But there was other stuff going on out in the world, which maybe we don't need to get into. But just so you guys know, Brian found out that at this time the number one song in America was "Kiss from a Rose" by Seal, which you can still hear today if you go to your local drugstore, because it'll probably be fine. So if you miss that song, you know, you don't have to go far to listen to it. So Brian, let's talk about this show. First of all, this show is a lot of similar tracks from the show we talked about yesterday, Live Tracks 4, mm-hmm. but some different ones as well. And there was a guest, which is going to lead into one of our discussions, David Ryan Harris, who before this show I had never heard of in my life. No idea who he is, and he plays a pretty big role in this Live Tracks release.
Yeah, he's all over this Live Tracks release. We'll talk about it as we get into the middle part here, but he's a guitarist. He plays some slide guitar, he plays some blues guitar. He hangs out for 6 songs of the overall show and really kind of makes his presence known in a way that kind of contrasts the work of Tim Reynolds, but adds, you know, an aspect to Dave Matthews Band sound that I think like accentuates and like it takes the bass level songs that they've written and really adds a ton of color to it. I was really into his performance throughout here, but I was the same with you. I had not heard of him, and he kind of reminded me of like, there's a lot of artists in the Dave Matthews Band universe that the band does a really good job of like pushing forward and showcasing and bringing on stage that I don't think ever reached the level of Dave Matthews Band in terms of fame or in terms of notoriety. But I think it's a really respectable thing that the band has done. They've kept openers going for a long time. I don't know if they still do it, but when I was seeing them in the early 2000s, there was an opener at every single show. Yeah. And it was a cool way for them to be like, we love this artist and we want to put them on a pedestal and showcase them to the larger musical world.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And this was in the middle of the Summer 95 tour, which was basically promoting Under the Table and Dreaming, and 31 out of 30 or out of 41 shows. So we're sort of at the tail end of the tour, getting there. So Brian, how do you want to get into some of these themes? Because I know that you had some thoughts getting into like how this show affected you.
So I think what we were going to do, we wanted to essentially focus on 4 main themes of kind of, we've each brought two themes to the table that I think can help us inform the larger show. I do want to bring one thing up really quickly before we jump into the themes. And that is, we were talking about this a bit yesterday with regards to the Crash release party and how big of a show that was. At this point in time in 1995, Dave Matthews Band is only 4 years into their career, which is insane to me. 4 years into Fish's career is 1987. And like their biggest gig at that point in time is Nectar's. By 1995, Fish is almost 15 years into their career. It's just so crazy to me to think that this band was able to play a concert like this that has some experimentation. They're changing up the set list on a nightly basis, but to your point, they're still pushing an album that came out a year prior that was a pretty, you know, modest but significant success, and then an album that's about to come out 8 months later that's going to be the biggest album of their overall career. I guess just quickly, like, what are your thoughts on like the trajectory of this band's rise? And like, do you think it was a positive? Do you think it was a challenge for them? Because the conversation we're going to have tomorrow is about a show that happened 11 years later that kind of is the after effects of all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think it seems to me like it was a much more commercial kind of point from the beginning, right? Like especially compared to Phish, but I know we don't want to always make those comparisons, but
yeah,
this was like about making albums, promoting albums, touring, having radio hits, and then over time, I think having really interesting live performances that evolved. I mean, I think the early shows, you know, that they played in Charlottesville and like some of the stuff I've heard from the early days are also interesting, but it seems like they were from the beginning kind of like pointed in this direction of being a commercial band, you know? And I think the trajectory kind of shows that. I mean, you know, it's interesting. We haven't talked about, we haven't really talked about Red Light Management at all yet. And,
right.
You know, Corin Capshaw, who runs Red Light, which now manages, you know, Dave Matthews, Phish, Chris Stapleton. I mean, tons of others.
Dozens,
maybe hundreds. And, you know, Corin Capshaw now like owns most of the city of Charlottesville and actually owns the bar that Tom and I went to in the British Virgin Islands called the Soggy Dollar. So anyway, he's everywhere. But he got his start as a manager in the early 90s, and he was the owner of a bar in Charlottesville called, you know?
Was it Trax?
Trax, yeah.
That's it, yeah.
And he gave Dave Matthews their first weekly gig and then began managing them. So he's, you know, a very well-respected music manager and clearly has been there from the beginning and still manages Dave Matthews. So, you know, I think they were really pushing to take these guys, you know, as far and as high as they could. So that to me is what sticks out in terms of the trajectory. And I do think, well, I want to go back to Robbie Lewis's comment here. The newest Live Tracks, which is Live Track 60, which we someday will talk about, was from 1995 also, and also features David Ryan Harris. And Tyler brings the stats. David Ryan Harris has been on 46 songs at 22 shows. So thank you guys for that intel. So yeah, I mean, I just think from the beginning they were pushing this as a let's make a successful band, you know?
I think it can't. I think also to your point, like Dave was writing songs that were very appealing on a mass level, and that was something. It, just to use the comparison, like of Phish, like their catchiest songs at this era are If I Could, Fast Enough for You, Down with Disease is the one that gets the video, but like that's not really a song that's going to catch on to the larger public. Like, and they're not really pushing songs, like they're deliberately recording songs like Strange Design in such a distorted way so as not to break through as a hit single. And I think they were kind of looking at where Dave Matthews was at and saying, okay, we want to have a little bit of that, but a little bit of freedom from like the spotlight. And I think it's just wild just to consider like 4 years into a career, it's a significant amount of time. You've got a lot of reps. They play almost 200 shows in 1995. But it's also at a point where you still relatively don't know your lasting career and who you're going to become. I think that's probably a good way to like get into the overall episode, because as we said here, we have a couple of themes that we want to utilize as kind of a leaping off point into the larger episode and into the larger show. My first is kind of based around this dichotomy that you find and the fascination I find as we're listening to these shows, because on the one end, again, you have a band that's playing legitimate hit singles. And on the other end, there's experimentation and there's risk-taking within those. And we hear that everywhere. My initial thought here is Leroy Moore's impact on a jam. And I hear it in every single show that we talk about, either his presence or his lack of presence. And I think one thing that separates yesterday's show that we talked about, 4/30/96, with today's 8/23/95, for me, is hearing him wail and hearing him have a real big impact on an overall performance. And I thought initially from like One Sweet World, right from the jump, the third track in the overall show, you've got this extended intro, you've got him coming in just like a really gorgeous way through the refrain of the song. And he just impacts this over and over again for me in ways that like just kind of blew me away. What are your thoughts in terms of the impact that Leroy Moore has on the overall sound of the band and the decisions they make?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's, you know, it can't be underestimated. I mean, I always go back to, it just reminds me of like a live Springsteen show, you know, just because the sax is a huge part of Bruce's sound. And I love Springsteen, and we're going to talk about him someday on this show. So I think it really like adds a lot of color, and it's sort of related to your other theme that I think we should talk about. And it relates to David, you know, guesting on the show, but it's interesting because it doesn't really like make it, you think a saxophone, like what Clarence Clemons did was he like amped up the rock and roll of the E Street Band. Leroy Moore makes it like more of like a sexy saxophone, like lounge jam. You know what I mean? They serve totally different purposes, but the way it can be extended and pushed in slightly different directions with that sound, without it, I don't know what the band would sound like. It's just such a integral part of the sound.
Yeah. It almost takes a band that exists in, at least to my ears, like Americana folk, and moves it into an urban area. And I think you're right. There's like an 80s jazz element, especially at this era, to what Leroy Moore is doing. But like, I think back to the first live tracks that we talked about, the 12/8/98 version, where like by that point in time, and ConcertVids has a really great point here, inspired by Branford Marsalis playing on Sting's Nothing Like the Sun. There's a jazzier element, and there's a more experimentation element to him within just 3 years period in time. And, you know, you think about the way that Crush and the way that the Before These Crowded Streets album changes the overall sound of the band. Just listening to this record, One Sweet World, Jimmy Thing, like those two examples specifically, like hit me really hard in terms of what he does to the overall band. And it's a good question you ask. Like, I don't know. I mean, we now deal with it. The band has existed, I think, for longer, at least close to longer without Leroy than with him. Obviously, they've had replacements in the horn section that we'll get into as we get into later era episodes and later era shows. But, you know, you have this. What he brings to the table, I think, was slightly overlooked in the time. And I think looking back, you really wonder what impact this band would have had if they didn't have him, because it adds such a unique element to their overall sound.
Yeah, I think that's a good, I agree. And I think that's, it sort of like you just take it for granted that this is just part of the sound.
Right.
And I want to ask you, Brian, I mean, one of the things I wanted to bring up is this, just the decision making about live tracks, because we're on number 5 here, and I just think this is it's a good show. I enjoyed like all of them, you know, listening to it. I think the middle, you know, the Exodus Jimmy Thing, that's what, like 25 minutes or so of just kind of jamming, which I think is a highlight of the show. But I wonder what the decision making is at this point, you know, when you're thinking about releasing these live shows. They have hundreds, thousands of shows, right? There's a lot of guests on these live releases, which we talked about last week. But why do you think this particular show was added? Is it because it was like, you know, the Under the Table and Dreaming tour, and sort of solid show with some guest appearance that kind of ups the game? Or why this show, do you think? And because I'm like seeing these kind of jumping all over, you know, just in terms of time frame, which is fine. But I wonder what makes this show particularly special or worthy.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to this that I'm going to pose, but I'd love to hear if someone in the comments has thoughts about this. I don't know if the band is making these decisions, or if management is making these decisions, or if these are voted on in any sort of way. And I bring that up because, again, like the two comparables that we have, the Dix Pick series is selected by the Grateful Dead's archivist. And from everything I know, Dick Latvala, from everything I know, the band had a little bit to do with like the first two or three releases, because they wanted to make sure, like, okay, we give approval, we know what's happening. But by like Dix Picks 5, Dix Picks 6, the band had nothing to do with it. They were just it was Dick saying, these are the shows that need to go out there. And his goal, his stated goal was, I want shows that showcase the band at their peak, but aren't heavily traded and aren't well known, which is why you get like 12, 1973 is the first show that comes out. When Live Fish came out in 2001, those were famously selected by the band. Page, I think, listened back through a bunch of shows and selected those in 2001. And then the second volume that came out, volume 7 through 12, were decided by the whole band. They all selected a different volume at that point in time. And that's important because that's the band saying, there's a lot of 2000 releases in those where the band is saying, hey, we want to highlight what we've just done, which was to the kind of pissed off parts of the fan base who was like, we were just at these shows, release the archives. In terms of these shows, again, I don't know exactly who's determining where, what shows to select, but as I'm looking at these, we're 18 months into the selection process here. It strikes me that there's kind of this inherent balance, and we'll talk about this again tomorrow, between let's showcase what we've just done, hence the Golden Gate Park show from 2004. We're really proud of that. It's a recent show, Santana, and these kind of highlight moments throughout our overall career. So you get December 98, you get August 2000, you get the Crash release party. This show, to me, my guess would be the Red Rocks 95 set is a really popular, one of the most successful releases the band has ever done. It's kind of the snapshot in time. Let's showcase a slightly different exposure of that same band. And that band is kind of like the classic Dave Matthews Band, where they're not pushing Crash yet, but a lot of these songs are written. They're really running on the, how energized is Dave at this point in time? How well is the set list that we've written? There's some jamming. They've got these friends who they're going to bring on stage and they're going to jam with them. That's my interpretation. What about you before I say anything more?
Yeah, no, I think that, that all makes sense. I think the guesting is the thing that sticks out to me the most, just because in Dick's Picks or Live Fish, you don't see really any of that. Unofficial releases. Not that, you know, it's a different, totally different animal, but it's interesting to know the, or just to think about and talk about those decisions. What else? What else do you got?
Before I jump into it, because you led to my topic. Really, really good note here from Concert Vids. A lot of the mid-90s releases are a showcase of a unique show from a tour, which I think we'll see that as we move forward in this. There's a lot of like, this is a really popular tour, this is a really popular era, here's a show that highlights that. So you just said like there's a lot of guests on these, and it leads me to my second theme, which is, what if Dave Matthews Band had an electric guitarist from the start? Obviously, Tim Reynolds plays on a lot of these, and this is a conversation we had back in our very first episode, which feels like it was months ago, but it was just last Tuesday. We've done five of these. It's crazy. Tim Reynolds was on the 12/8/98 performance, along with Bela Fleck. David Ryan Harris is here guesting on, as we noted, six songs. I think specifically the Jimmy Thing is really where he's showcased. There is a closing jam to this performance of Jimmy Thing that like blew me away. Mellow. It's kind of jazzy. It teases some Jimi Hendrix with Third Stone from the Sun. It's like a little psychedelic. It's not really in your face. There's not a ton of dynamics in it. It's really just like, sit back. And I wonder what it would have been like in the venue at the time, because it feels like a very quiet jam. And it feels like it works really well in the evening, throw on some headphones or put it on some really nice speakers and hang out and listen to it. It's something you kind of have to focus on, which for me reminded me of the jamming in Live Tracks 1, which I love that type of jamming from this band. And it just made me wonder, like, you talked about this in our first episode, like, what would this band have been like? Is this the most, I think you said, is this the most successful band without a lead guitarist in like the rock world? And it really makes me wonder, like, what would have happened if they had electric guitars from the start? I don't know if it would have been like a full benefit, but like this peek into them really gives you kind of an idea about where they would have gone.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, like, you know, some of these releases are focused on shows where like the viewer said earlier, you know, are focused on a unique show from the tour. And partially that's because they have these electric guitarists who guest with them. But at the same time, like if there's, I don't know, like highlighting these guest appearances from electric guitarists shows that someone, whoever's making these decisions, thinks that it's a pretty cool thing when that happens. Right. Or else it wouldn't be kind of highlighted at least twice in the first five releases. But I assume that Dave had a lot of options to get an electric guitarist involved, you know. I don't think it was because they couldn't like find the right person. I'm sure that around Charlottesville and in the music world, like there were plenty of people who would have played with them full time. But I think what this, like the comment you just put up there from Concert Vids, if they had an electric guitar player from day one, it would have taken away from the acoustic percussive greatness of the band. And I think that's totally true. I mean, it would have just changed the whole direction, and maybe they wouldn't have been as successful because they wouldn't have been as unique and a little bit more distinctive from other bands of the time who were playing. I mean, just thinking of like the Spin Doctors and Blues Traveler and like a lot of bands that were kind of in the same scene that had sort of a more traditional setup and a more traditional sound, and they were just writing songs, and some of them were hits and some of them weren't. It definitely makes it for a much more unique, unique sound. So it seems like it would be interesting to hear Dave talk about that. I don't know if he's ever talked about that in interviews, but I think that's an interesting question, you know, to ask him, because I'm sure that it crossed his mind many times, you know. It's sort of interesting that's something that never happened. Although Dave and Tim, like they toured extensively together, right? So it's not like,
right.
I mean, he was playing with a lot of electric guitarists, but I think it's interesting. And I think there's like a lot that, well, we don't know the answer, but I think there's a lot like to dig into there. And I'm looking forward to hearing more of these sit-ins, because I like the Tim Reynolds stuff and I'm very familiar with it, but some of these other probably slightly more rare sit-ins are pretty cool to hear.
Yeah. And I think as well, like to that point, it's wild that now Tim Reynolds is a formal member of the band. He's on stage with them on a nightly basis. And I think part of that is, has to be, you know, Leroy Moore leaving, tragically passing in 2008, I believe it was. And, you know, losing that dynamic of the horn, and who do you replace that with? You know, obviously Jeff Coffin is there now, but Tim Reynolds is really like the guy who's going to showcase, like he's going to take Dave's songs and he's going to throw them out in a totally different way. I think this point from Concert Vids is really, really insightful here. And I think also Lily White didn't let Tim play with Distortion, Under the Table, and Dreaming and Crash. So Tim plays an acoustic. Tim in 95 was turned down a lot to let the band play. That seems like a very like concerted marketing driven point of, this band is successful as they are, let's not make them like everybody else by having a lead guitarist, which again, I'm not complaining. It's just kind of like an interesting question based off of this release. But you had a lingering theme about kind of the covers that we find throughout these releases. What, tell me your thoughts.
Well, this is going to segue into our awards, because I was shocked at your bathroom break. But I just think we talked yesterday about All Along the Watchtower, which also appears here. That's like a real staple, obviously, of the repertoire. But I think that Exodus is the only other cover on this show, right? 16 songs, and there's two covers. I was looking at the show flow. I think there's like, you know, All Along the Watchtower gets a little bit of a dip. And I'm surprised that in the show flow, the two dips are Pay for What You Get, which actually I think that song is great and such a Me so too. Nice to hear in this show. And one of the other big dips is Exodus. And I thought the jam, I think it was like a well-placed cover and a pretty cool portion of the show between, you know, that and the Jimmy thing, which again is like almost 25, 30 minutes worth of music. I don't know. I feel like they do a good job of using covers and using them like pretty sparingly for the most part. But I take it you didn't love the Exodus.
I just have a hard time with white hippie jam bands playing Bob Marley covers. I don't know. It feels like I'm walking into a college dorm room again. And I got that image of Bob Marley with the joint in his hand. And I'm like, I know exactly where I'm at. We're about to play some dubstep. We're about to hang out. Someone's going to pull out the roar bong. We're going to hang out for like 30 minutes. And the whole time I'm going to be checking my watch being like, all right, when can I just go back and listen to some Fish in my dorm room by myself? And that's me. This is me. So, you know, I hear Exodus coming. I'm going to be hanging out for the start of it. And we got some comments here. I don't mean any shade at anyone here. This is my opinion. Exodus has only been played 23 times ever. Shout out to listener Tyler Broadbeck. Last played 10/2/2007 with Steven and Ziggy Marley guesting, which that is really cool. That's pretty cool.
That's cool.
We were able to get them on stage.
That's pretty cool.
For me, I just know what I'm getting out of this. It's going to remind me of not just college dorm rooms, but like college bar bands that are like, hey, we can play some reggae, but can you? You can play reggae better when you got Carter Beaufort on the drums. I figure I'm 9-10 songs into the show right now. I go grab a drink, go use the bathroom. I come back. And I'm in time to sit comfortably with a full beverage. Hopefully it's a venue that provides a tall boy of sparkling water, because not enough venues provide that. And someone who doesn't consume alcohol, especially at concerts, that's something you all need. So I come back with a full beverage and I hang out for a nearly 15-minute Jimmy thing that's going to blow my mind.
All right. I mean, I'm not going to take that away from you. I'm probably going to go take my bathroom break during Tripping Billy's, which is, I'm not sure why. I think it's because it's something that like you hear fairly, it just doesn't seem like that special. It's about that time, you know, it's about 45, 50 minutes in. I need to get another beer and take a break. Although if I came back, maybe I would have wished that I'd waited and gone during Love or Lay Down, depending on who I was with at the show. If I was with you, we probably wouldn't be dancing together. So if I was with my wife, maybe we would. But Tripping Billy's also, you know, we've listened to a bunch of these, and sometimes it's really like jammed out and there's long, you know, kind of an extension. This is just a very short and sweet version. So that's where I'm going.
It's also, I think, Tripping Billy's, I don't know this for sure, but I think it's been in, if not every live tracks, it's been in at least four of the five that we've seen thus far. It's, I get it. You just have to sprint because you got a 4.5. Like I've got 12 minutes to do my thing. You've got 4.5 minutes to get back. There better not be a line is what I'm saying.
Right. Exactly. I also, according to Ants Marching, there's at least... There's 50 of live tracks, right?
60.
Looks like 60. It looks like there are 25 to 30 that have Tripping Billy's on them. So, solid half.
It sounds about right in terms of its performances. I was just checking, like Watchtower has been played over 800 times, which is crazy. Like when you compare Dave's set list versus Fish's, like the most Fish song, the most performances of any Fish song is You Enjoy Myself, which I think has been played about 500 times. So there's like a 300 show gap there, which is a significant gap in terms of, you know, what you would consider being overplayed. And I don't have the stats. I guess I can check it right now, thanks to the DMB Almanac. Let's see how many times Trippin' Billy's has been played. 1,069 times.
It's a lot. It's a lot of Trippin' Billy's.
The like least amount it's been played in a year was 2011, which I believe was a shortened touring year. I think that they only played like segmented shows as they were celebrating their 20th anniversary, and 2020, which everyone had short performances in 2020. They only played it once, but in 1995, I mean, we're looking at least 35 performances. I that's just incredible.
So it's okay that I took a break there.
You're hearing a lot of them. You're hearing a lot.
Yeah.
Conservids has a good point here with Jimmy thing. You get out, you get back during the jam, and there you go.
Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but Brian, who's your MVP of Live Tracks 5?
It's Carter. I know I talked a lot about Leroy, but like, there's something about Carter Beauford's drumming that just makes a song pop in a way that like, it would just be a dude with an acoustic guitar playing funky chords, singing really personal lyrics, but then you add Carter behind it, like this studio session perfection drummer. And it just elevates all of these songs. And it's one thing, we'll talk about it tomorrow. Like, even when we're seeing lower tier debuts, newer songs aren't fully connecting with the fan base. Like, you listen to Carter and you're just like, I don't really care. And he adds so many fills, so much color to these songs. And this era, he's really, really coming into his own from a band standpoint. What about you? Who is your MVP?
I was thinking about Leroy a lot while I was listening to this, partially because I was like, we have this document and you brought that up. And so I think some of the color and some of the texture that he adds to some of these jams is just really just outstanding. So I'm giving it to the sax player.
I don't think you can go wrong there. I don't think you can go wrong there.
What about the jam of the show? Because this is we had a point of agreement here.
We did. And so we're hanging out during the jam of the show. We're both refreshed. We're both hydrated. We're in a good spot. We may not be hydrated. Who knows? Someone came back. The guy next to us is passing a joint that's been going since the start of Exodus. And so we're chilling. We're hanging here. And we're both stoked on this extended take on Jimmy thing. Tell me your thoughts on this Jimmy thing.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the guest sit-in is really like brings it to a different level. And it isn't like a, you know, raging rock jam, of course, but I think there's like a lot of great, it's just a lot of great guitar playing that I think adds a lot to the jam. And I'm just a real sucker for this song. Like, I feel like it's always when it comes on, which is like almost every show, it's never a bad thing. There's a little Third Stone from the Sun, as you mentioned earlier, which is always fun to hear. There was like a lot of there's a lot of good jamming in there. I really enjoyed it.
It's, to me, we're going to talk about this tomorrow. Tomorrow has maybe my favorite jam that we've heard thus far in the overall series, but this is there for me with the number 41 and the Seek Up from Live Tracks 1, Sugar Will from Live Tracks 2. This just like this Jimmy thing, it's one of those songs that like you hear one and you kind of think you've heard them all. You know that they're going to take it down tempo, it's going to be kind of elongated, it's going to have this like weird cross between of like smooth jazz and folk rock kind of jam into it. And it's going to have like a little bit of funk to it. And this version kind of blew my head off in terms of like how they approach this jam. And, you know, perhaps that is from a guest sit-in standpoint from David Ryan Harris. Perhaps it's just like where the band was feeling and they were vibing at this point in time. Yeah. But I loved this jam.
Speaking of guests, Brian, tomorrow we're going to have our first guest.
We are.
And we've been corresponding and we'll introduce him tomorrow, but he has some deep, deep knowledge and experience, and he's going to bring a lot to this. And I think this release that we're talking about on Thursday, tomorrow, will be pretty, it's going to be a pretty, pretty big discussion, right? This is an important, important volume. Conservids, Live Track 6 is the most controversial live tracks for audiophiles. They kept tweaking the crowd volume up and down. Also not the best sounding recording. I've seen shows at Fenway. It's hard. It's hard to get the sound.
Baseball stadiums were not meant to be concert stadiums, but they are for a lot of them, which we'll talk about a bit tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be a jam-packed episode. It's two shows from the summer 2006. Crazy. Some classics, some rarities, some new songs.
Yeah.
I think we get one repeat. I've listened through to these. I have thoughts. I have opinions.
Well, I'm gonna go listen to them now. I'm gonna drive home, and we're excited to have a guest, and we're excited to keep this going. Thank you guys all for tuning in and hanging out. 38 songs. That's what we're talking about. Robbie, thanks for the comments. Thanks for the comments. Thanks for hanging out. And one of the best set list runs from the Live Track series. All right. Well, everyone's excited about it. I hope you guys all come back tomorrow to talk to us about this and share your thoughts. And until then, Brian, I think we're going to stop being live. But we'll be back live tomorrow.
We're going to go backstage. We're going to hang out. And I don't know. I may listen to some Bob Marley. We'll see. I hope you have a good day there, RJ.
Thanks. And thank you guys for tuning in. Thanks everybody for listening on the podcast version, and see you guys soon.
Osiris.